Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Squepmukulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Squepmuk people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, farmers' markets are playing an increasingly important role in the distributing of fresh, local, and healthy food to citizens. Between 2009 and 2021, farmers' direct sales to their clients and their customers from over 500 farms to over 4,000 now. This form of direct sales is fueled by increasing citizen demand for fresh, local produce, as well as an interest in supporting demand and local economies, and getting to know who is growing their food. Farmers markets also offer a way to build real and positive relationships between consumers and growers. And the effect on the economy is very big. The BC Farmers Market Nutrition Coupon Program, which provides food to low-income families, distributed $4 million worth of fresh local produce to participants in 2023. In that same year, research showed that direct sales of $155 million in farmers' markets generated an even greater amount, $233 million, of spin-off economic development in British Columbia alone. Perhaps the most important outcome of farmers' markets is the development of community resilience and cohesion, tied into the positive social atmosphere, which I have experienced on many occasions, and the relaxed mindset which pervades every market day. Today we have two people in the studio who play a significant role in the Sorrento Farmers Market, which has been in place for a quarter century and continues to be a vibrant presence in that community every year from May till Thanksgiving. Denise Griffiths is its market manager, and Larissa Stagg with Sweetacre Apiaries is one of the Sorrento Market Farmers Market's full-time vendors. They're here to tell us about this valuable social and economic resource in that community. A warm welcome, Larissa and Denise.
Good morning, Warren.
Good morning, Warren.
Delighted to have you here in the studio. Now, from my own direct experience, I can say that the atmosphere in farmers markets is always kind of upbeat. And one way that you guys make it happen is you have music. Denise, why don't you tell listeners a little bit about what the music is and how you get them in there and how you line them up, and do they plug into a chord or what do they do?
Most musicians sign up with us at this time. Most of my bookings are booked up, filled for the year. We have bands coming. One of them, the Mountain Mamas, come from the North Shore, actually, North Shreeswap. There's three ladies within that one. We have a couple other. I have musicians that actually come up from the Vancouver coast.
Really?
And book a date with us periodically over the summer. They have family in the area, so they will come up to visit family and they'll perform with us. They actually perform at some of the local bars as well while they're in the area.
They put in their time.
They do.
Oh,
yes.
That's lovely. Do they, the people who come from far away, do any of them come just because it's a lovely place to be?
Yes, actually. Yes, we do get travelers that come through quite often. We get repeat travelers that come through. Yeah. One of the nice things about the Sorrento Market is we are a highway location.
Yeah.
So we get a fair amount of tourists all summer long.
Good location, 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 location. Now, you've been doing this for 4 years. And before that, you actually had a tent. Now, you call them tents or booths? You call them tents?
Tents, stalls.
Stalls.
Different terms depending on,
you know
who
what
you're
they
talking
are.
With.
You know
yeah.
what they are. And you had an artisan operator. Tell us a little bit about that.
We used to create bats, birds, bees, butterflies, and ladybugs. Houses for all of them is what we did.
A lot of bees.
It was Birdie Creations was my company.
Of a different kind of bee, yes.
Yes. Mm. Gave it up a couple years ago. Wood prices went kind of skyrocketing, and we found it hard to keep our prices lower. So we ended up actually giving it up, and I ended up stepping into being a market manager. Keep me in the market scene. I really enjoy it, and I love who I work with.
What was that transition like, being just your own space, managing your own space, and then managing all the space collectively?
Actually, I enjoy running around chatting with everyone. I am not tied to a booth or a tent.
Yes, yes.
Like my vendors are. They have to stay
they
there
to
and
stay
greet their
and
customers.
Do their job.
Yes, I get
right,
to run
Larissa?
Around.
You have to stay.
No, I don't. I wander up and down the market, every single market.
Oh, well, there you are. You see, all sorts of opportunities. Now, you work with the board of directors.
Yes.
What sort of people are, I know Larissa's on the board. What's the board consist of? What kind of people and what do you do with them? What's your interaction with them?
The board is vendors themselves. Mm. We have full-time ones and all full-time, I believe, actually. Mm. Yes, mm. They're all full-time members. Our market does host alternate spots and occasional as well. Mm. But yes, the board is full-time. We plan things together. The board is the one that approves the vendors, mm. approves the products. After that is done, then I plan the maps. Mm. If people are absent, I make sure all the spots are filled.
Mm. How do people get involved? Do they just come to you, the board, or just word of mouth? I mean, there's a lot of word of mouth in a small community.
All of the above. Emails, Facebook. We do have a Facebook page. So I get messages through Facebook. I get emails. I get text messages. And we get people coming to market inquiring.
I tell you, the digital communication system has changed a lot and made it very hard mm-hmm. to get away sometimes from the interaction. Now, Larissa, you and your husband, Bill, how many years have you been coming to the market?
I've actually been coming to the market for 24 years this year.
Right after it started.
Right after it started. Mm. We actually started coming when we were working at Wintergreen Farms. Mm. So I have been pregnant at that market with every single one of my kids. So I have three kids. I started bringing produce from Wintergreen Farms. Mm-hmm. And then when that kind of retired.
Yeah. Well, you changed.
You
guys changed your venues.
Yeah, yeah. We actually got into the market alongside another vendor. Mm. She gave us a little bit of market space because there was no space available.
So you were sort of a joint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and then they gave me a stall because they wanted a full-time honey person. So.
And there you were, full-time.
Yeah.
Sweet Acre Apiaries. How did you come up with that name? That's got to be, I can guess, but.
Actually, a lot of names came forward. My husband chose that one. We were living in Larch Hills. I wanted to be Mountaintop Honey. He goes, that's too generic. We were living on a couple acres. Mm. He called us Sweet Acres. Mm. So.
And you told me something about the aroma generated by bees is, among agricultural aromas, something to be prized.
We've worked on dairy farms, we've worked on produce farms, we've worked in lots of agriculture over the years. It is definitely the best smelling form of agriculture you can get.
Compost, manure, okay, yeah. I'm listing off the possibilities.
You've ever been on a pig farm, it is not glorious.
You don't have to be on a pig farm, you can be within about 10 kilometers of a pig farm and you know where you are. So you were working, getting into the honey business was not the first thing you did. You were working on this large 50-acre farm.
60, actually.
60, with percher on horses.
Yes.
Now, what's that like? They're big dudes.
Yeah. I mean, the gentleman, Mike Carr, who ran the farm, mm-hmm. knew horses. Mm. And he had the horses. If you've ever seen a tractor in a field and a transplanter behind it. Mm. Do you know what a transplanter is?
Transplanting.
Yeah, it's basically a wheel that picks.
Wheel.
Yeah, it picks up the plants that you put in it, and it puts them in the ground, and then it covers them up.
Yeah.
He had the horses trained to be in like low gear, and if you've ever, it's like clop, clop, yeah. clop. It was amazing, and these horses would walk between the lettuce as he like cultivated, and it was amazing. Like, it was absolutely astounding. And I was six months pregnant with my son Liam, driving a team of four horses, jumping up and down off the wagon, pitching stooks, doing a threshing day. And I'm probably one of only a few people in the world at this point who can actually say that who aren't Amish.
So, and you're not Amish.
No.
Well, there we are. That settles that.
Yeah.
That settles that. The way you got in, though, was a little bit circuitous. Mike had some stuff
Yeah, Mike had some bee equipment, which he always intended to keep bees on the farm because, I mean, you diversify, you get into a bunch of different things, you try different things. And he knocked on our window one day and said, hey, you guys are into this down-to-the-earth goat thing. We had a herd of 15 goats. We had geese, chickens. We had some greenhouses we had built up at the place we were living at and a bunch of garden beds. He's like, do you want to add some bees to it? So my husband went down to the library. This dates me.
Isn't that an interesting library?
Yes.
Not the internet.
No, we had dial-up, which was very unreliable and a really old computer. So he got the stack of books out, and within a couple days he's like, honey, we are going to be beekeepers.
What was it specifically that made him bees are nice and all that, but what was it that got him going?
Part of beekeeping is you can be a beekeeper and live in a apartment building on the 20th floor with no outdoor access. And like, beekeeping is one of those things. It's kind of like land squatting. You go to people's places and you say, can we put bees on your property? And we will give you a bucket of honey for it. And
bribery. Well, the best thing you can imagine.
And agriculture is very hard to get into. And you need a lot of land for most agriculture.
And creatures that pollinate are very much prized. I mean, there's lots of wild bees and, you know, local bees, bumblebees, etc. But this organized approach with the European honeybee, which swarms and does special things that you can sort of make use of, is a bit different. And you started Sweet Acre Apiaries in 2005. So this is roughly...
That's when we registered the business.
Okay, we'll call it the official opening that everybody had to pay attention to. I'm just going to remind listeners that we have in the studio Denise Griffiths, who's the market manager with Sorrento Farmers Market, and Larissa Stagg, who you just heard now, speaking about her work with Sweet Acre Apiaries, who is one of the prime tent bearers in the market. Now, Denise, you got somebody like Larissa turning up, saying, I want to be a vendor in your farmer's market. What's the process that, you know, takes place thereafter? What happens? How do you get the vendors involved?
Well, like most markets, we do have an application process.
Do you have a form?
Yes, we do.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Sorry, everybody. We have forms.
Yep. There is an application process. It's on our website. It lists all the fine print for the vendors. Food vendors do have requirements they have to follow. Mm-hmm. There is interior health we have to worry about. Health permits, depending on what their items are. As well, insurance for liability has to be paid. They do need food safe certification as well. And these are all BCAFM, BC Association of Farmers Markets. They are all their requirements.
Do some of your new vendors say, oh my goodness, all this paperwork? Do
yes.
they all say it?
Yes, actually.
The old vendors say that too.
Exactly.
A lot of paperwork.
Yes. And it is a yearly. They do have to resubmit all of their paperwork to me every year. So.
But they don't have to have new paperwork. They just fill out the form again for
yes.
you. And how many vendors are there? I mean, I know it fluctuates, but on average, roughly how many are the...
This year, including our full-time, our alternate, which is two vendors share one spot,
yeah.
and they share the
alternate weeks.
Comes 1 week, one comes the next. And then we also have what we call an occasional list. When I have vendors absent for a day, I use vendors off the occasional list to fill the spots, which keeps our market full every week.
And keeps you busy.
It
making
does.
A lot of phone calls.
It does.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness gracious.
And waiting for replies.
And when they've signed up, they've filled out the paper, they grumbled, filled out the paperwork, got their ducks in a row, as they say, then you slot them in the order you've just described, the permanent vendors, they have their spaces. Do they have the same space? Larissa, do you go to the same space in the market every time?
Yes. I have been pushed around a bit because I am flexible.
But
how delicately put, my dear. No, but I mean, of course, you have priorities, Denise. You have to kind of mix and match.
We have about 30 spots that we fill every week, but my list between the full-time, alternate, and occasional, I have over 50 vendors right now, and that will increase as the summer goes on. I get applications all summer long.
And when they've fulfilled all these criteria, do you aim for a particular mix, like not too many artisans and not too many farmers, kind of a balance, or is it just whatever
and
happens?
That actually is not my department. That is the board of directors. They are the ones that choose our vendors. They are the ones that approve the products.
Yes.
I then get the approved list, and then I make my map.
You make your map.
Yes.
You make your bed and lie it. My goodness. And they lie in it. Larissa, on the board, what kind of stuff do you end up doing? You have people coming and approaching the board saying, we want to be a vendor. How does that work?
We get applications. We get people who come to the market and are like, we heard you're the vice president of the farmer's market here. I would like to have a booth here. How do I get one? I'm like, well, first you have to apply. They're like, well, can I set up right over there? No, you can't. And we're a true farmer's market. So it's make, bake,
grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They added forage as well now.
Well, those are rules with the Farmers Markets Association. Yes. They've set out the criteria.
Yes, we have to follow that. So all of my vendors' food-related idea have to be make, bake, grow, and they've actually added forage to the list as well.
I love that. Yeah, yes. there's a couple of people at the Farmers Market in San Juan who do foraging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we are also, we stick with the rule, no genetically modified food.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think you probably would not want somebody who says, I'm a great proponent of Roundup. I mean, they probably wouldn't say it. They wouldn't admit it. Now, one of the things you have in your market is you have seafood, but the ocean is not close. So
no,
why don't you explain, Denise, explain that. How does this happen?
Tanya Ray Fishing is a local company out of the Kamloops area. She vends in quite a few markets around, I believe right through the Okanagan stretch all the way over to Kamloops. She also does large shows in bigger centers as well. The family itself does fish off the coast of BC.
Yes. So they're real
tuna
fishers.
Yes, yeah. They are. Tuna, halibut, salmon, canned steaks, halibut steaks they sell. They sell canned tuna, salmon, shrimp, all kinds. It is amazing and it is very good.
You've eaten some.
Oh, very good, yes.
You've both eaten some. Well, that's the best endorsement. We'll consume some of the product that our vendors are selling. Mm-hmm. Larissa, how far is it from your farm, to the market? Because this is an issue that, you know, the world food supply is measured in thousands of food miles or food kilometers. But your food kilometers are pretty modest. How far away do you have to, how far do you have to travel to get to the market?
Depends on construction. I live in Tappan, so I actually have to go back to go forward. It takes me about 11 minutes to get to farmer's market. Mm-hmm. So
where is your farm? Is it up in the boonies?
No, it's in Tappan. It's within 2 kilometers of the highway. Mm. We have a small acreage. All our bees, though, are on farms, mostly organic or non-commercial farm. Well, there's some commercial organic farms from Chase to Vernon. So long distance.
Now, you're also growing lots of things on your small acreage. You said you'd always had a garden.
I've had a garden
since you were a kid.
Since I was 7. I planted my first garden at 7, and I made my first batch of 12 loaves of bread, which my mom did once a week when I was 8 years old.
That's like Mozart writing a sonata when he was 6. you're the Mozart of gardening. What kind of things were you drawn to when you were growing food as a kid? What was the part that you really liked?
I actually have always loved food. So I love
that's
cooking.
Good.
I love like anything. I love grabbing a carrot out of the garden and munching on it.
How many people say that? You know, taking peas out of the pod and taking carrots out of the ground.
It's actually less and less because less and less actually have that like actual experience of going into their backyard garden. A lot of kids have no idea. They are absolutely stunned. They come into a garden and they're like, they pick a pea. And that's where Melanie Bennett, it's like she brings kids out to the garden and she actually has them like pick peas and pull carrots and eat a cob of corn off the, like you can eat raw corn. Mm-hmm. And most people are like astounded that you can eat raw corn. You don't have to cook it. Oh my goodness. Anyway, but no.
But the bees are a central feature of what you're doing. I learned the word nukes by reading your blurb about Sweet Acre. What's a nuke?
A nuke?
Listeners, this is not a weapon that blows up and does things.
A nuke is basically a small beehive. It is 4 to 5 frames, sometimes 6, of bees, brood, which is different stages of from eggs to like just about to hatch bees, and a queen, and usually some honey. So we're stock producers. So we breed queens.
Meaning you produce bees for other people.
Yeah, we produce bees for other people. So we breed queens. So we graft them and we grow them and then we put them into little tiny incubator colonies. And then we go in there and we hand pull every single queen. So we pick it up by its wings and put it in a cage with 4 other people to help it along the journey.
I'm so glad you said people because it's sort of, they are living beings and they have their own ways of doing things.
Yeah. But yeah, 4 attendants, they take care of the queen. Yes, she's royalty. So 4 attendants, they take care of the queen and they make sure that she is fed, make sure she has enough moisture and everything until she gets to her destination. We ship them in the mail.
I was reading the other day that bees can transmit 200 different kinds of information back and forth.
I'm surprised it's so little.
Well, it probably, as time goes by, we'll find another 500. But the idea when the dance that bees will do to give directionality to the other bees and tell them where the pollen source is was a big deal about 45, 50 years ago when it was discovered that they were doing something. They weren't just sort of, you know, using up energy. And all sorts of astonishing things happen in hives, protecting the hive from predators, keeping it even temperature, you know, all sorts of stuff. Do you find that that's part of the fascination for you?
Oh, totally. When my kids were little, if I used to babysit kids, I am not a kid person, by the way. I shouldn't say that on radio, but I used to babysit.
But you do a good job of pretending you are.
I babysat a lot of kids when I was little. If they fell down and hurt themselves, I would be like, let's get out the honey and smear.
Cure them up.
Oh, you know what? I have had so many wounds over the year. We had a friend whose daughter fell against a wood stove, and she was very pale. Very, very, very pale. And she left skin on the wood stove.
Dear me.
So we grabbed the honey because we're in the middle of nowhere. It's the mm-hmm. middle of winter. Mm. We grabbed a jar of honey, smeared it on her arm, wrapped her up. She doesn't even have a scar.
Mm. Yeah, it's one of the treatments that in emergency rooms is really good. Cover it. You know, don't let the air at it because that's what stings like heck. Now, you're hearing all this, Denise. This is the background behind the vendors that you, when you now wander around, you can talk to them about stuff like this.
All the time, yes.
What's that like having this kind of social venue that's built out of this kind of primal engagement with the natural world? You know, you get to know, farmers have to get to know their whatever they're growing. They have to get to know the seasons and that kind of stuff. What's it like for you as you hobnob with these people? Must be kind of once you got everything set up.
Actually, it's amazing. I love chatting with them. My knowledge grows every time I speak with one of them. Mm. Different experiences on their farm. Like Larissa, it's what happens on her farm is what gets her to my market. All of them have different experiences. They all have their own animals as well, our farmers type thing. I have some that are, I have one that has longhorn. Her beef is longhorn.
Good Lord.
Yes, and they're in Turtle Valley, Chase. Yes, she is actually a board member as well.
Maca Ranch.
Maca Ranch, yep. Yes.
And do they, Do they do a cattle drive?
Actually, one of her main mamas actually has one horn going up and the other one goes down. She is very unique looking, pride of the farm. They also have goats, lambs. They do pigs, chickens, egg as well.
They're one of those transplant farmers that they started a couple years ago, and it was something they just wanted to get back to
basics.
Yeah, back good healthy. Nature. So they bought a place in Turtle Valley. And
so when you say transplant farmers, somebody who wanted to do farming but didn't have a background in farming. Yes. How many people like that are you seeing now? Denise, do you?
Actually, quite a few.
Yeah.
A lot.
Well, you guys, you know, Bill went to the library. Mm. I mean, now I'm sure he goes to the internet. But I mean, it wasn't like we had, well, you did find out that on his side of the family, there was some beekeeping experience.
Yeah. His father was a beekeeper out on the farm in Saskatchewan.
But he wasn't saying, I want to be a beekeeper.
No.
Just at a certain point, boom, the light went on.
No, both. His older brother is a mechanic, and his dad was a mechanic, and he figured he'd be a mechanic. And that didn't last very long, though he is very good at fixing vehicles. And he's fixed a lot of things over the years.
Well, I think the farming training, when it's formal, there's in our country, it's almost all informal. You just learn it from somebody else, or you read something about it. But in countries like Germany, they have a 4-year university or college-based program where you learn everything you could possibly learn about farming, which means you learn how to do fixing of things, mm-hmm. like trucks and tractors and all that kind of stuff.
We actually had a student from Germany come out. He was Montessori or Waldorf. Anyway, he came out and he was on a 1-year, he couldn't be paid. So 1 year going around the world learning beekeeping because he wanted to learn in different areas. So, yeah. So he came for 3 months to Australia, 3 months to New Zealand, 3 months to Canada, and 3 months to the United States. So he was 18 years old and showed up on our door and was just part of our family. And it was, it was pretty, but he was like, he wasn't allowed to be paid. He was there for work experience. He wanted to be a beekeeper.
And you helped him along his way. Today in the studio, we have two wonderful guests, Denise Griffiths, who is the market manager of the Sorrento Farmers Market, and Larissa Stagg, you just heard, talking about bees, whose business is called Sweet Acre Apiaries. Now, Denise, you've done a lot of things in your life, and everything that a person does gives you a skill or an experience or an orientation. Why don't you talk about some of that? Because it's played into being able to manage a lot of people with different backgrounds and different orientation. Worked in the legal world for a while. What kind of stuff?
Legal world for a while. A legal assistant. I've also worked for realtors as a real estate assistant using my legal training. As well, property management. I did that as well.
And retail.
Retail. Actually, I am a home hardware employee at Scotch Creek. I am also vice president of the North Shuswap First Responders, their society, and I'm a dispatcher for them as well. So I have the three hats that I wear.
You've got all these connections. It seems to me that a farmer's market is the epitome of connections.
It is.
Why don't you describe the kind of swirling world of connections that you try to orchestrate? It's different every day. It's different people, different
ideas.
It is
very different. One of my vendors, Red Truck Foods, Connie Orr, Tom Price, they've been vendors for, I believe, 16, 17 years with Sorrento. Connie is also the market manager of the Celista Farmers Market and the Scotch Creek Farmers Market on the North Shore.
So you have a little shop talk with
her. We do as well, yes. So the markets all kind of intertwine as well. A lot of the vendors vend at many of the markets. Some of my alternates are alternate vendors with Salmon Arm and with Kamloops.
Do you have vendors whose financial security comes solely from farmers markets?
Yes, yes.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, because for years it was sort of an adjunct. It wasn't really the main thing where farmers would go.
Yeah. Our president, Eric Fells, KZ Farms, that's his sole
income. Sole business. Yeah. Sole income is produce.
What does that give you, Denise and Larissa both? What first of all, you, Denise, you're looking at the whole mix overall. What do you see in sort of patterns, the kinds of people who do it? Obviously, there are people, what were you calling them before, people who just drop into farming?
Oh, transplants.
Transplants.
I like to actually say they're very dedicated. Yeah. It takes dedication to do that job. They are up very early and they go to bed very late.
Larissa was
2:30 last night.
Oh, well, this morning, actually.
This morning, actually, yes.
Yes, yeah, so today, earlier today. But there's also this compensation with farming, and it's reflected in the farmer's market, and that is that you live where you work, you can have a home where you grow your food, you don't have to rush madly down the road to, you know, buy something to eat. You know you'll all be... During the Depression, prairie towns, which were self-sufficient for food, did much better than people in large urban centers because the food, which is a fairly basic thing, I call my patients addicts of food, they eat it every day. It's really central to your well-being and your personal survival.
It is. Yes, it is. We all need food. And just like Larissa and her bees, we all need the bees as well. Her bees support my farmers.
Now, one thing you told me about working in home hardware is that you don't have a license to sell pesticides. And that gave you a certain amount of joy. That's an issue that comes up a lot. What do we put onto the food we eat? And people are starting to say maybe we shouldn't be using some of the chemicals that we've been using cheerfully for 40 or 50 years, since World War II anyway.
Yes, purchasing your food from a vendor, from a farm, you know where your food is coming from. You know how it has been grown. It's been grown with more loving care than a commercial farm, selling to a larger plant to produce it, to distribute it. Mm. Our farmers have care in their growing every day. That is what they are doing, and they strive to produce the best that they can.
Mm. And you can see it.
Definitely. Eric Fell, we have people coming from very far away to purchase his produce.
Mm.
His produce is loved. It is his farm is in Silver Creek behind Salmon Arm here, but he does travel to the Sorrento Farmers Market, and that is his main market that he attends.
Interesting. Larissa, you produce and sell more than just honey. I mean, obviously you sell bees,
mm-hmm.
and bees come in swarms.
Hopefully not.
No, but
they can't swarm.
In the natural world,
yes.
That's what they do.
So that's what we mimic. When we're actually producing our bees, we're mimicking swarming. So bees will swarm sometimes once, sometimes like 7-8 times out of one colony.
Why do they swarm?
They swarm to keep going, to keep the next generation of bees out there. That's why they swarm.
So they get so many bees in a particular hive?
And the more swarms go out there with daughters, the more those genetics and the more that next generation of bees ends up populating the world and ends up chance of survival. I mean, there's so many things out there that can take care of bees and diminish them. I mean, there's
take care in the negative sense.
Yes, take care in the negative sense. There's animals that love bees. And I mean, everybody thinks that bears, they go after honey. Bears like honey, but most bears will eat every single piece of larva out of those hives because they like the protein and it's yummy. So
you've had, at one point, you said up to 16 swarms landing in your...
No, I went after them.
You chased them. You're a swarm hunter.
Yeah, no, they were... some of them were calls. Swarms had ended up in people's yards or wherever. Some of them are... Bees attract bees, so we get swarms from other people's bees. There's lots of beekeepers over the years in the shoe shop area that have also been... Not the most on the ball beekeepers. So there's lots of bee trees still hanging around. They, every once in a while, like our next door neighbors in Cedar Heights, they had one right in the tree, right in the lot next to them. You could see the bees coming and going for like a couple of years. Down at Blind Bee Resort in Sorrento, they had a bee tree there that finally fell over. It was a big, huge, massive stump, and it fell over and the bees absconded. They left. And, but they had been there for years, and lots of different colors of comb. Yeah, there.
When you get up close and personal with bees, you have to know what you're doing. But you were pointing
out, it helps.
Yeah, it does help, apparently. But what is true about bees, you were explaining before the show, was that when they are swarming and when the bee, the queen, is there, they're actually this fantasy about bees going around madly stinging humans is actually untrue. They become fairly docile.
Okay, so there is always a degree or an element of...
Don't ruffle their feathers or their wings, I
should
say.
Yeah, and I mean, some bees swarm and their queen goes missing. And then they are just not happy bees. Because, I mean...
Is it because they're frantic? They're trying to find... A home, like a queen home or something?
If they don't have a queen to kind of keep them, like the queen is, the workers are who manage the hive. They tell what this egg is going to be. And if they're going to develop a whole bunch of queen cells because the queen's not doing very well and doesn't have enough eggs to last as long as what they need her to, the workers are the ones that dictate a lot of what goes on in the hive. But without a queen, they're hooped. They die. There's nothing left. Like, yeah. So the queen is like the most important bee in the hive, but they all work together. And if she goes missing on a flight, like they're out swarming and a bird comes in and snatches her up because she's big and tasty and delicious.
Right.
The bees don't know what to do. So, and that does happen sometimes. So the bees take a lot of care with their queen and try to protect her. But sometimes, and you do not want to go get a swarm that doesn't have a queen. They're not overly...
Because they're frantic, aren't they?
Yeah, they're just, they're discombobulated. They're like...
Disoriented.
Yeah. So.
There's so much lore attached to bees that's built up over... literally thousands of years, because people have recognized their pivotal role. The Bill has ended up being the bee inspector. I don't know if he's still doing that now.
No,
he did it for a while.
I think almost 8 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he did a lot of traveling, met a lot of people. We also worked for John Gates, who was one of the people who helped develop the bee breeding program in North America. So he's an amazing mentor. He's a good friend too.
A lot of people don't realize that the honeybee that we know, that
it's not native.
No, it's a European import.
Just like dandelions.
Yeah, exactly. And why are people upset about dandelions? I have no idea. And we're definitely not upset about honeybees. They really play an important role in...
Well, and what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of the crops that we grow, like dandelions, but like alfalfa... A lot of the stuff that we grow, we need the pollination of honeybees. Like the native bee does a good job on native plants. But there's a lot of plants out there that honeybees can't access. And it's kind of, people are shocked because they're like, oh, they're taking food away from the native bees. And I'm like, no, have you ever seen...
They work in parallel.
Yeah, they work in parallel. And I mean, there's a lot of things that we grow that without honeybees... They just would not be pollinated enough. So
almonds, I've heard.
Oh, yuck.
Totally dependent.
Canola is another thing, and I'm not overly impressed with the canola industry, but I will not go there.
We will not go there. Denise, why don't we talk about a typical day at the Sorrento Farmers Market for you, because you have to be the mother hen managing the whole process. Why don't you just walk listeners through a day for the market manager in Sorrento's farmer's market?
My morning starts with setting up tents for the farmer's market itself. We do have a community tent where we host the coupon program. Recipients of coupons will come to that program or that tent to pick up their coupons.
Okay.
I also set up the music tent. We have nonprofits that have a spot at our market as well. We have one stall that I alternate nonprofits with. Girl Guides have come out. South Shoe Shop First Responders are coming this year. Sunnybrae Senior Center is another one that uses it as well. I set up all of those tents, get them going.
So you do all the tents?
I do 4 tents for the market itself.
Okay.
Yes. Vendors do their own. Yes.
I was getting worried.
Yes. No. Vendors do their own. I assist if need be. New vendors coming in, I make sure they know where their spot is. One side of our market, vendors have to be there a little bit early before the 7 o'clock hour. When the other line, our north side, comes in, they actually block the one side.
Oh.
So, yes. I have to make sure one side is in earlier and the other side comes later. They block them. They can't get their vehicles in.
Except for me.
Except for Larissa.
I can get my vehicle right down market and turn it into my stall.
She's
without.
She's very good at parking. And Amanda with Forest and Food Fixation is another one that's very good at parking. We have a couple.
You prize them. You don't want somebody to run over somebody's foot or knock over the corner of their tent.
After that, yes, market gets started. Customers start showing up, greeting them, chatting with them all day long idea. Vendors will have new products that they would like to sell. They have to get approval from the board of directors, so I can do that while at a market.
Oh, you do it on the fly?
On the fly idea, yes. Has to be approved before they can sell. So they bring it with them. We show it to the directors. They each have their vote, and then it goes from there.
I see lots of experience in different relationships in the work environment with different kinds of people showing up, and the way you're just describing it, you keep moving, you keep
all day long. My coffee mug gets lost in many tents all morning long. I am always looking for my coffee mug.
Familiar story. Remind listeners again, I'm speaking today with Denise Griffiths, who is the market manager of the Sorrento Farmers Market, and Larissa Stagg with Sweetacre Apiaries, who's one of their main tenants. Now, Larissa, as one of the solid, stalwart vendors at this market, you like to arrive as late as possible.
Yes.
Describe the methodology and the reason behind arriving late.
It's not about arriving late. I have been doing this for a very long time.
Mm.
And I don't get a lot of chances to sleep in. And it's more about I get there, I set up really, really quick. I usually have everything on the table and no problem before the 8 o'clock. So, yeah, it takes me like 10 minutes to set up my booth.
Is that the official opening time?
Opening time is 8 a.m. and we run till noon. Yes.
So and if you want baked goods, get there early in the morning.
Baked or produce, yes.
I've heard that story.
Chris from White Lake Organics, her cinnamon buns sell out so quick.
And last year she had a record of over 300 in one market.
300
cinnamon buns.
Sold.
Yeah.
Sold. Gone. Every
Created
single one.
And made that morning as well. Yes.
They're warm.
Fresh that morning.
Yeah, I mean... We're all getting hungry.
My stomach's already growling.
They're going to be tough. This is tough.
That is what a farmer's market is for.
Exactly. Food.
And coffee. We have 6 beans. They've been at our market for several years now. Yeah. They actually started at our market. It was the first market they've done. Really? And and it's our cup of coffee every morning. So,
well, you have the essential ingredients. Why don't you just describe a little bit of the mix of... You know, some of Larissa obviously is a key component, but what are some of the vendors that you have that really are stalwarts and have been coming for a long time and really support the market and thrive in it?
For our meat end of it idea, we have Mecca Ranch. They do beef, pork, chicken. We have CC's Farm. They are out of Tappan. She does beef, chicken, pork as well, I believe.
Yeah.
She does eggs as well. She also, both of them also use some of their
Like Larissa said, you try to use as much as you can on your farm idea. So they actually have cosmetic products as well. Tallow is being used in face creams now. Christina also uses her goat's milk, creates a soap line and facial creams as well as the meat.
And they sell.
And they do sell very well, yes.
Do you find that customers are becoming more educated? They're sort of looking for things.
Definitely.
They know what they want, and it's something natural.
More than natural.
Yeah.
Yes.
Products
farm to table.
Yeah.
And that works in cosmetic as well, not just the food.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Larissa, products with less ingredients that they could actually make at home.
Yes, that too.
When you raise your bees, one of the things that's going on in the bee world that's quite prominent is diseases that affect bees. Mm-hmm. And you guys are quite careful about what you do about it. Organic acids comes to mind.
When we first ventured into beekeeping, we got involved in all the typical stuff that, like, pollination and treating bees for mites, because you have to. The varroa mite is something that if it's not treated,
Gets out of hand.
And there's every climate has a learning curve when it comes to when you treat and everything like that. We use formic acid and oxalic acid, which are both found in honey.
Mm-hmm. And found in food. Well, yes. Formic acid found in ants.
But. Yeah. But formic and oxalic, spinach.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're rhubarb.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's, we use basically the bees can tolerate it, they can deal with it, it doesn't damage them, but it damages the actual mite.
The parasite.
So those are the two we use. We used to use a mite strip, which is commonly used, but it's a pharmaceutical product. Mm. It will also build up in the wax, and we do not like things, because we burn all our beeswax candles. Like, I make a ton of beeswax candles, and we burn them, and I don't want
chemicals floating around the air.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, everything builds up, and when you burn it, it off-gasses.
So, Denise, you've had a successful market, and the vendors are looking at their empty tables and saying that was a good thing. What's the wind-down process at the end of the market day?
Actually, Larissa takes 10 minutes to set up and probably 5 to tear down. When market is finished, vendors want to get home. They've been there for 5 hours usually at that time. We're out in the sun. It's hot, 30 degrees plus most days come August.
Yeah, what's on the highway, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Heat sink.
Yes, most of them are gone pretty quickly, actually. Some of them actually have other sales in the afternoon to go to. Some go home and they still have the farms to worry about. It is a break off the farm in a sense, but they still have to go back and deal with the farm.
So how long would you say it takes from, you know, there's no gong going off, but the timing is there. Okay, it's the time
they're
to end.
There, say, 5 to 6 hours. Yeah, probably an hour before, and then some of them are there an hour after.
And how long does it take them, like, the decks to be cleared so that you have no idea that there was a farmer's market there?
What happens when 12 o'clock hits?
Yes, exactly. It's very quickly usually taken down. Usually by 1 o'clock, there's nobody left in the parking lot. My final job is to make sure that parking lot is clean and left the way it was when we got there.
So what do you have to do? Go around with a big broom?
No, just make sure everything is picked up. Yeah, sometimes you'll get corn in the corn ears or something.
Yeah,
I just cleaned the parking lot up.
So would you say that your vendors have a sense of responsibility?
They do,
yes. And that's something about a community-based entity. Mm-hmm. People know that other people will see what they've done, and if they just throw things around and leave them there. You know, you go to a big public event in a large city, there's about 2 hours of cleanup that goes on afterwards. But obviously for you, it's a very abbreviated process because of people looking after their own responsibilities. Let's talk a little bit, we're sort of getting a little bit towards the end of the show. What is climate change doing for you as somebody creating life forms that are very affected by the weather and what's going on? What are you seeing, Larissa, as the climate is shifting?
Bees are very adaptable. So they can, if you've bury them in snow. Like, when we lived in Larch Hills, we used to bury our bees in snow, like the beehives. Take a shovel, scoop, scoop, scoop. That was the insulation they needed. They were good till spring. I mean, bees live in all over North America. They live in some of the coldest areas, and they survive even even out in the wild, bees can survive in buildings. They can survive as long as they have a little bit of a windbreak and insulation. Mm-hmm. Bees can survive. So we've not had to really change what we do much over the last 20 something years.
What about things like wildfires? What does that do?
Well, remember when we had that heat sink and the smoke mm-hmm. and everything, probably about four years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was our biggest crop of honey. It was 20,000 pounds of honey.
And what was the reason for that?
When nature throws us a curveball like smoke, a lot of plants will be like, I need to survive. So they will start producing flowers at a very short stage,
right.
Produce a lot of nectar because they want to produce seed really, really quickly.
Right, for the next generation of plants.
So if you noticed last year after the fires here, everything had more bloom on it. Things were greener. Yeah. Everything needs that cycle. Like even wildfires, we need that. Mm-hmm, it is good for our environment. It's good for our plants. It's good for our bees. Yeah. Usually after a fire, bees do actually pretty darn well. But
please don't take
I know
that
no but
wait everybody
but it's one of those things. I mean, wildfires are something mm-hmm. that like grass fires on the prairies is something that happened, and that grass fire activates different seeds that are in the ground that mm-hmm. then germinate, and those seeds don't germinate That's unless right. you have that fire. So it's the same thing with everything. There's this ebb and flow, and it's
well known now that our active commercially oriented fire suppression process that's been going on for many, many decades has actually created problems because it's stopped the natural cycle of naturally occurring wildfires, which have done exactly what you're saying. They activate seeds. They do all sorts of things that regenerate the forest. Are vendors that you're talking to, some of them influenced by, say, the fires or water shortages or other kinds of things in the as you're wandering around talking to people, do you find them thinking about that now these days?
Yes, I would say so. They all have animals that need access to water as well, besides the veggies.
Yes,
idea
indeed.
The produce, yes. Our winters are changing as well. It could affect how some stuff in the ground is stored idea. Look at last year. We had no stone fruit in this area. Mm-hmm. We had to go to the U.S. to get our fruit.
It was quite something.
Yeah. First year ever without peaches or apricots at a farmer's market. Very, very, very unheard of. As part of BC Farmer's Market, we were not allowed to allow our vendors to bring it in from other farms. It has to be brought from their farm to a market. So we did not have sales of stone fruit last year.
But on the other hand, mm-hmm. this year, our the people that we pollinate for, there is a extra load of blossom on the trees.
Yes.
And they're looking at a bumper crop of cherries and a bumper crop of a lot of the stone fruit because
peaches,
things, as I said, ebb and flow. Last year, because of the cold and because of the weird weather we had in the spring. But this year, the trees are like, they're back to being, they want to produce seed. They want to produce fruit. So, yeah. No.
Several years ago when the highways were washed out, it made it very clear that locally grown food had a special resilience that a 5,000-kilometer food source in China or Mexico didn't have. Mm-hmm. Did that register? Was that part of the conversation that took place at the farmers market?
Grow local.
Yes.
That is one of the main things you hear at farmers markets, grow local. Mm. And our farmers do like to use other farmers as well. Shoe Pops is a vendor. Her popsicles are made by local fruit.
Yes.
Yes.
And local honey.
And local honey and local coffee as well. So, yes.
Well, the coffee is actually probably grown.
Well, not local, but it is.
I know what you mean.
Yes, it is
roasted
local. It's roasted local, yes. But, yes, our vendors pride themselves on farm to table and using their neighbors as well.
Now, you both have a next generation under your wing, you know, children. What do you sense they see in, just before we cut off, what do you sense they see in the farmer's market and what it brings to the community? Do they think about it?
My kids were actually part of the farmer's market. They've run a booth. And my son, when he was little, actually played his violin and bust at farmer's market and sold compost worms and compost. That's my oldest.
I actually have youth vendors that come out now. Yeah. We actually have 5 youth vendors on our roster. Yeah. And I am actually this year for the first time, I have a daughter and father musician team joining us. So yes, the kids are getting involved in the farmers markets just as much as the adults. And some of my youth do not have parents as vendors. They are the vendors. Their parents are helping them be a vendor. They're doing it on their own. They are a first-generation vendor.
That's the way to do it, yes. Well, it's been a lovely visit with you, too, and hearing the stories you have to tell, but also the perspective that you bring, you know, that local food and healthy food and community engagement is a really important thing that probably we all need, we've always needed, and we kind of got away from it for a while, for the last maybe half century or more. But now it's coming back, and you guys are at the forefront of that happening. So, Larissa and Denise, thank you so much for being with us today in the studio and sharing your stories. They're wonderfully inspiring stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.